Years ago, a Vietnam Christian vet came into my therapy office carrying a Bible, and he said, "If you want to know what it feels like to be me, read these verses." And he started pointing to some of these verses that Michelle read this morning. I don't know specifically what precipitated the psalmist's despair that caused him to write the verses we heard this morning, but I do know that I have been told by numerous vets that it's a good description of what they feel like. Thousands of years ago, after those words were written, psychiatrists and psychologists came up with an official diagnosis and a new name for an old malady. A malady as old as war itself. And in 1980, the term post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD as we commonly call it, was coined and since then has become part of our medical and our common lay vocabulary. Throughout history, different names have been used to describe the effects of the emotional and the spiritual pain that people who've been asked to kill experience. And the name has changed, but when you go back and read some of the old journals and diaries of medical people, you realize they're talking about the same thing. Way back in the 1600s, affected Swiss soldiers were said to have nostalgia. During the US Civil War, writers called it the staggers or irritable heart, some interesting names. The terminology of World War I was shell shock. And then in World War II and the Korean conflict, we heard about combat neurosis and battle fatigue. And as I said, for veterans of the Vietnam War, and since, we called it post-traumatic stress disorder. Some of us, for years, have been calling that post-traumatic soul disorder. And it's interesting that although the psalmist doesn't use scientific psychological language, it's rather startling how similar the feelings that he describes are to what vets today and for the past number of years have been saying. Listen again to what the psalmist says. These are from my version of the Bible. "There is no health in my body. My guilt has overwhelmed me. My wounds fester. I am bowed down and brought very low. All day long I go about mourning. My heart pounds. My strength fails me. The light has gone out of my eyes. My friends and companions avoid me. My neighbors stay far away from me. I am troubled by my sin." For those of us in the therapeutic community, it was a very useful new diagnosis to have a name for something that we sensed for years but couldn't quite put our finger on. And it also became much easier for veterans, after the PTSD became part of our official language, to get insurance coverage for their war-related emotional problems. And I will confess that there was at least one Mennonite therapist who, humbly, I hope, said, "See, we told you so." I remember having some interesting conversations with some of my colleagues, and we were talking about some differences that we were noticing between a group of clients that all had been given the PTSD diagnosis, and they tended to be victims of sexual assault and rape and veterans. And what we were intrigued by was, while they all had some common debilitating symptoms that were similar, there seemed to be something different about the PTSD of veterans. There seemed to be a deep shame, a sadness, a sense of self-loathing that we didn't see in non-veterans. But it was something that was hard for us to get our hands on, and it certainly wasn't part of the PTSD paradigm. In 1980, there was a young journalist named Peter Maron who was asked by Rolling Stone magazine to do a story about the experience of veterans who were coming back from Vietnam and trying to become integrated, reintegrated back into their communities. And Peter wrote an article after he interviewed many soldiers and listened to them. And when he turned in the story to Rolling Stone magazine, they thanked him and said, well, this isn't quite what we had in mind. What Peter said in that was that he had found a deep sadness, and their sadness seemed less connected to things that had happened to them, to war injuries, but more related to things that they had done or things they had seen their buddies or their officers do. So a year later, after Rolling Stone magazines turned down the story, it was published in Psychology Today, and the name of that article was Living with Moral Pain. And Maron described moral pain as having done something or seen something done that violated some deeply ingrained sense of right and wrong. And I think you theologians call that a conscience. It was really encouraging to Christian therapists to realize that a secular publication was naming something that might open the door for consideration of spiritual issues and the soul wounds of veterans. In 1986, Father William Mahidi, and I just want to say that I want to dedicate in my own heart this week's interchange with you to Father Mahidi. He died in July, and he was a Catholic priest who joined the military as a chaplain during the Vietnam War and became profoundly disillusioned and heartbroken at what he was asked to do as a chaplain. He realized that he was asked to alleviate veterans' guilt so they could go back and do more killing. And he had a profound crisis of conscience and dedicated the rest of his life to being a social worker in San Diego, starting veteran centers and writing profound pieces about the spiritual woundedness of veterans. And Father Mahidi, I was introduced to him when I was working at the Center for Justice and Peace Building, and one of my students was married to the man who had been the chief of chaplains during that time. And when she went through my class on recovery from trauma, she said, you have to do something like this for veterans. And actually, the Johnsons, this chief of chaplains for the military, gave a significant amount of money for me to do research and try to understand better the wounds of war. And they introduced me to Father Mahidi. He wrote the book Out of the Night, The Spiritual Journey of Vietnam Vets, which is one of the most insightful books I have found about the spiritual wounds of war. And Father Mahidi often said to me, Carolyn, you Mennonites, you Quakers, you Church of the Brethren people, you are the ones who need to be working with recovery of the spiritual wounds of veterans, because you've known from your beginnings how war and violence damage the soul. And he was my greatest cheerleader in any work that I've done with vets. And so Peter Maron's term moral pain and the term that Father Mahidi came up with, moral strain, which were actually the same thing when you listen to them talk, were terms that were put out there, but as a nation, we weren't quite ready to start really looking at the implications of what we had asked veterans to do in the name of our country, many of whom were mere 18-year-olds when they went off to that war, and over 58,000 of whom came home in body bags. And I don't know how many veterans have said to me, the ones that came home in the body bags were the lucky ones. For them, the war at least is over. And it reminded me of something I had read that Plato had said many, many years ago. The war is over only for the dead. And so we as a nation watched as thousands and thousands of Vietnam veterans came home and turned to violent, abusive, self-destructive, and other destructive behaviors. We saw them more and more filling our homeless shelters, living on the streets. But it was, I think there were some peculiar things about that war. There was a national shame that we had lost that war. And I think it was much easier for us to blame the veterans for the condition they were in psychologically and spiritually than to really analyze what that war had done to us as a people. And so when people would talk about the problems of vets, it was often language like, what's wrong with them, or what's wrong with him? And the conclusion that many people reached was that there must have been some kind of pre-existing character fault or mental weakness that accounted for the problems they were having. And it was very rare that I heard anyone write or say, as opposed to what's wrong with him, what happened to him? I don't know about you here in Indiana, but out west, I'm sensing a much more compassionate, open-hearted response to our returning veterans. And I must say that Vietnam vets who have managed to stay alive are often the ones that have spurred our communities to do a better job of walking with veterans. There is a deep sense that I'm feeling that we have somehow failed our veterans, and I think it's very exciting as a Christian to realize that it's not just pastors and Christian therapists who are starting to talk about the spiritual issues of war, but it's become a much broader conversation. There is a new term, and I hope that you'll watch for this, because it's being used more and more in military language. And I owe a lot of what I know to psychologists who are employed by the military. I have a friend who went as a captain to Baghdad, and after 3 months in her role as a field psychologist, where she would try to medicate the depressed, traumatized vets, give them 24 hours of rest so that they could go back and continue the fighting. After 3 months, she experienced her own breakdown and came home and was diagnosed with PTSD and is on permanent disability in the military. I have another friend who is a psychologist who worked at Walter Reed with returning veterans, and she became so overwhelmed with the pain of broken vets that a few months ago, a colleague found her on the 6th floor of Walter Reed on the roof at part of the building, and she was going to jump off. She was so traumatized and in such despair just from listening to the stories of vets and realizing the degree of pain and brokenness that they're returning with. In December of 2009, a little over 2 years ago, there was a journal article that appeared in Clinical Psychology Review. And this was the first professional journal that used that term, moral injury. And it said, moral injury occurs in war when a person does things that transgress deeply held beliefs, witnesses that in others, or witnesses intense human suffering and cruelty. In that same month, December of 2009, there was a gathering of clinicians that worked for the VA. And they were called together because of the alarming rate of suicides. And I don't know if you realize this, but there are over 18 veterans a day in this country who successfully commit suicide. And people within the VA say that it number is probably much higher, that a lot of the motorcycle accidents and car crashes that kill veterans are probably intentional. And that number keeps going up as deployments continue, as people go for their third, fourth, fifth deployment now to Afghanistan. And what this VA article says, when they were describing moral injury, they said moral injury is the extreme distress brought about by perpetrating, failing to prevent, or bear witness to acts that transgress deeply held moral beliefs and expectations. This is from a military gathering. And they made it real clear that moral injury can occur from things that you do or from things that you witness. And the conclusion of this large gathering of VA psychologists was that this moral injury is a significant factor in the high rates of addiction, of homelessness, of suicide, and clinical depression in returning vets. And in fact, they made such a persuasive case that the VA has recently given the National Institute of Mental Health $50 million to study moral injury. I find this astounding, and I find it very, very encouraging. I don't know how it is in Elkhart and Goshen, but I know that it's hard in Oregon to pick up a newspaper any day and not see another story of domestic violence or of a murder or of a terrible violent act that has happened. I want to tell you, and some of you were here a couple years ago in chapel when I told the story of Joseph Dwyer, but I want to tell you that story again, parts of that story, because for me, it has become such a central story to understand the pain of veterans. I'm going to pass around a picture that I have of him in addition to this one, because I want you to look at the face of this man, and I want you to try to look into his heart. Joseph is a young man who, after the events of 9/11, volunteered to join the army because he wanted to do something for his country. But he told his family, I don't want to kill people, I just want to help. And so he volunteered as a medic for the army. And he had only been in Iraq 1 week. And there was a fight out on the outskirts of Baghdad, And there was a young boy in this picture who was about 4, who was caught in the crossfire and had a serious wound in his leg. And Joseph was standing with a group of American soldiers, and just instinctively he ran across where this boy's father was holding him and waving a white handkerchief. And Joseph ran over and got this boy to try to help him. There happened to be an army photographer who was embedded with the troops and caught this picture of Joseph and this little boy. And I remember right away seeing this picture in our newspaper. And it became kind of the iconic picture of the American soldier wanting to liberate and help the Iraqi people. Sadly, Joseph had another experience with a little boy. And it was not much longer, it was just a few days actually, after he helped this little boy. And this boy was about 12, and he was riding on a bicycle. And Joseph was standing with a group of American soldiers, and there was a gun that someone had dropped on the road. And the soldier beside Joseph mumbled under his breath, "Don't pick it up, kid. Don't touch that. Don't pick it up." But the boy did. He hopped off of his bicycle and picked up this gun. And immediately, the soldier, the American soldier beside Joseph, just riddled this boy with bullets. And Joseph ran out, and there was nothing he could do to help this boy. Things went downhill for Joseph very quickly after that. He stopped eating. He started having profound symptoms of trauma. And only 91 days after arriving in Iraq, he was shipped home, and his medical reports say that he had dropped from 220 pounds to 91 days later, when he reached Walter Reed, he weighed 165 pounds. He didn't want to go out in public even after he was released from Walter Reed. And he had the classic symptoms of whenever he'd go into a restaurant or any building, he would always sit in the back with his back against the wall so that nobody could sneak up behind him. He was diagnosed with PTSD and given the best meds that people know to give people for that. But he told his family over and over and his friends that he just could not get the picture of the dead boy that his buddy had killed. And so, because of these disturbing pictures in his mind, Joseph couldn't sleep at night. And he was given sleeping meds, but that didn't help. And so he started huffing aerosol cans and became addicted to aerosol and became extremely violent. And his wife, fearing for their child's safety and her safety, left him. They moved out. And Joseph then was admitted to an Army medical center again, this time for inhalant addiction. And people at the center said that he would sit in the dining hall hour after hour, long after meals were over, and he would alternate between flipping through a Bible he had or just poring over something he was reading in the Bible. And I wish I knew what Joseph was looking for. I can guess. After 6 months, he was released, and he was sent home with over a dozen prescriptions. And none of them seemed to heal the anguish of his heart, and none of them really helped him sleep. There was a long series of disastrous, violent things that happened where he tried to shoot up the apartment. Guns were taken away from him. And one night, he called a taxi. He called a taxi driver who had frequently taken him to the hospital. And the taxi couldn't open the door. And he kept calling And so the taxi driver said, "Joseph, can I call the police to help me get in?" And he said, "Yes." And the police came and opened the door by force. And they found Joseph in a pile of dirty clothes and blankets that were urine and feces ridden. And there were dozens of aerosol cans around him. And they put him, they left him there. The police called an ambulance. They put him in the ambulance. And Joseph died on the way to the hospital at 31. At his funeral, his mother said, "He wasn't Joseph anymore. My Joseph never came home from Iraq." And his widow, Matina, said, "He's at peace now, and he doesn't have to deal anymore with those terrible pictures in his mind." I confess that it's pretty easy for me to get overwhelmed when I think of over 300,000 veterans coming back from our current wars. And I sometimes wonder where the hope is. And I have been, it's been interesting for me that a number of people have pointed to the past, to the passage in Mark 5, the account of Jesus healing the man of a demon. And I don't know all of that man's story. I, like you, just know what's in the Bible. But I think it's fascinating that when Jesus asks him the name, or asks the demon his name, he says Legion, which I'm told is the largest unit of the Roman army at that time, the largest military unit. Mark tells us that he was living in the local cemetery, that he was violently out of control, that he cut himself, that he scared other people. And that sounds an awful lot to me like the veterans that live under the bridge in my town of Corvallis today. And after Jesus healed him, he sends him back, as Jesus so often does, back to the community and to his family. And the Bible says, "And all the people were amazed." I bet they were. And I also bet you that I did not learn a single thing in my secular academic program of psychotherapy that would have helped me help know how to help this man. Treatment protocols that are just coming out now for those who treat veterans seem to suggest that what's needed are some things that are unique to us as people of faith and to congregations. And I want to quote directly from a military manual. "Returning veterans need access to a caring, non-judgmental moral authority and involvement in a welcoming community that can listen to their stories, provide means for making restitution, offer forgiveness, and sustain long-term ties." If that doesn't sound like an invitation, indeed a plea for pastors and congregations to walk with vets, I don't know what it is. Healing happens best in community, and the VA says, in the same protocols, it says the traditional individual counseling approaches that have been used do not seem to be effective with returning vets. I hope that as we move through this week together, we will together come to understand what it might mean for us as congregations, as people of faith, to be a community that can bring healing and hope to those many, many wounded veterans that are coming back to our congregations, to our communities, and to our nation. And I would pray, if I dare, that God would let our hearts be broken by the things that break God's heart, so that we might reach out with hope and healing and tender mercy for veterans and their families and loved ones that are so profoundly wounded.